Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction or fantasy book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast for everyone to download and listen to. Joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello, everyone.
And today we are continuing on with our journey through The Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
The Two Towers. Quick question, which of the two towers in Middle Earth are being referred to by the name The Two Towers?
The towers, you know, the where Saruman is like hanging out at the top.
So the Tower of Orthanc in Isengard, yeah. That's one of the towers. And the other tower is, I don't know. Exactly. There are so many towers in this book.
Yeah.
In this middle book, there's like seven different towers mentioned that they're either trying to get to or trying to avoid or trying to move around and things like that. So I'm not sure. Maybe there's an official word on which are the two towers. I think in the movie, they kind of make it clear that the two towers are the, you know, where Sauron is and yes. Saruman is,
yes.
you know. So
yeah.
those two towers, which quick, let me look it up on the map. One of them is Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower, and the other one is Orthanc in Isengard.
Right.
So those in the movie, it seems like those are the two towers, like with the two sources of evil.
They made that decision, but like,
yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not really into like wondering about the different theories and this kind of stuff. I guess I could just look it up to see.
No. I'm not. I don't want you to look up what other people say. I thought like you had other towers.
Oh, for me,
in mind.
The Helm's Deep, the Berg. What was it called? Anyway, whatever the tower at Helm's Deep is.
Right.
I would say that's one of the towers.
Yeah.
Because that's, well, actually, no, that's not true. Well, let's get on to talk about the different towers and things later. But yeah, I mean, the obvious one is the two towers with the two bits of evil, especially in this one here.
Right.
Minas Tirith is hardly mentioned. They don't actually get to Minas Morgul. They do, but they see it, but they don't get there, you know.
Right.
So yeah, it's probably Isengard and, this, you know, Mordor Tower.
So basically, you think the second section of the book
yeah.
is about... We get to know about the evil, like we get to know more about the plans and what they do and what they
yeah,
want and who they are.
But here's the thing, kind of not really.
Okay.
Because, well, I wanted to talk a bit about, I mentioned in the last episode that I want to talk about, like I split up this discussion into different sections based on like the different people doing stuff. So
right.
Book one, which isn't The Fellowship of the Rings. It's like the ring sets out and rings go south. Like these, each one of these main books, which are like the ones that you buy, you know, as an Audible credit.
Yeah.
Or you get published. So The Fellowship of the Rings is two books. The Two Towers is two books. And
right.
The Return of the King is two books. So book one is about hobbits. Book two is about elves. So you get to know the elves better. Book three is kind of a lot about wizards.
Right.
And ents as well. But like it's a lot, there's a lot of wizard action in there.
Yeah.
And it's about developing friendships.
Okay.
Book four is about Gollum and the power of the ring. Book five is about men, but also people who are not men,
right?
And kings. And then book six is hobbits again and how hobbits have been changed by, you know, their quest and
everything,
all that kind
around
of stuff,
them,
you know.
Okay.
So I wanted to focus this time out on some of these different points.
Okay, good.
So
because I keep getting really, really confused.
There's
about
lots of different books.
The three books, the four books, the one book, the six
yeah,
books.
Yeah, there's I'm reviewing this entire thing as one book.
Exactly.
As one reading experience that I started.
Okay.
And that I listened through to three different audio book credits worth of audio.
Yeah.
But in the end, for me, that is one novel.
Okay.
Each one of these novels, there's definitely six. I would definitely say there's more that it's definitely more that there's six parts to The Lord of the Rings,
okay,
rather than three parts.
So could we then,
yeah,
from now on,
yeah,
concentrate on that rather
yeah,
than
okay,
you confusing me with, oh, it's the
well,
second
the thing
book.
Is, I'm joking around with how what I'm saying and this kind of
yeah,
stuff
and
to
I
make
get
it to make it more
confused,
confusing to express the confusionist. So let's talk about wizards because that's what this book three, you know, with the breaking up of the fellowship. I think the name of the book is called The Ring Goes East.
Okay.
You know, because it sets out, it went south, and now the ring, they're trying to get it over to, so I brought the map up here as well. So at the end of the Fellowship of the Rings, they finish up here, you know, and they have a fight, and then Two of them head across this way.
Okay, just to explain to the people who can't see what Luke is doing, he's hovering with his mouse over a map.
There's a waterfall here, and Frodo and Sam head across the dead marches, and they're trying to get to the gate here.
Okay.
And then they head down and go through this gate here.
Can I have a quick interlude question this map?
Yeah.
Where is this map from?
Oh, this is Christopher Tolkien's notes on a version of his father's map.
Okay.
So this is like a general map of the Middle Earth.
Right.
So it's like, it looks very much the same as like the normal Lord of the Rings style map that you know that's printed in the books. But it's a bit more expanded out. And I think these, all the red text here, I think is Christopher Tolkien. Again, I got this link to this map maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, so okay. I don't remember exactly what it is.
I just wanted to know. And one idea, I'm sorry, just to interrupt this. One idea was when you said, you started listening to the Lord of the Rings and then interrupted and went to the Silmarillion. Yeah. I thought that would be a really great time and opportunity to buy a hardcover book like a printed book to have the maps in front.
Yeah, but I talked to you about it. The maps in the Silmarillion are terrible because they don't show, they show bits of a map we did a whole section on that of map confusion of like trying to work it out. And I was like, oh, and all of this was flooded. So this doesn't exist. This is now under the sea.
Right.
That when you actually zoom out on this map, this bit of this map is like, if you actually go to this map here, those mountains at the edge of the sea are these mountains here.
Yeah.
And this is where the Shire is. And, you know, you see Fangorn, and then this bit here dries up. And, you know, so all of the Silmarillion is happening, or two-thirds of the Silmarillion is happening over here.
Okay, which is then flooded and
then you go back to this map, and that's all out here in the sea.
So Lord of the Rings has its own maps, basically.
You have to have a Silmarillion map and the Lord of the Rings Middle-earth map.
Right.
And you're like, why is it called Middle-earth? Because there's like lots of, it's like right on the edge, and it's like, no, it's the Middle-earth because the bit which used to be the west part of the Earth is all flooded. It's all, you know, Atlantis, it's all, you know, flooded away. It's like
the middle of the Earth is left.
Yeah, it's like, the Middle Earth is now the bit which used to be, there used to be stuff to the west of the Middle Earth.
Right.
And now all of that is gone. So you still get south stuff and east stuff and middle stuff, west stuff, flooded. It's gone. It's like the ice caps melted and it was all flooded. Mm. You know, like Dogger Bank in the North Sea, you know, it's all flooded out there.
Yeah.
However, and this brings me onto what I want to talk about with these wizards. Like, what are the wizards? There's all this stuff, you know, I see now because I've looked up a few different Lord of the Rings stuff. YouTube is like, hey, what you actually want to say is like, what you want to find out now about is like theories, fan theories and the lore of Lord of the Rings. And I'm not really interested about listening to other people's thoughts of what Lord of the Rings is.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find out what the, like where those theories come from, which is why I read the Silmarillion.
Yeah.
So I had the Silmarillion and various Tolkien's, Christopher and, J.R.R. and Christopher Tolkien's view of it. And of course, it's some of this stuff is mentioned in the appendices of Lord of the Rings.
Right, yes.
That you find out about the history of some of the main characters in the novel that you've just spent like 60 hours listening to an audiobook. In an appendix, you say, oh, this would have been really handy to know about here. And it's like, why wasn't that included in the main text? It's like, oh yeah, but nobody told Frodo about it. That's one of those things, is that like, if something happens but nobody tells either Frodo or Sam or Merry or Pippin about it, or they're
write
it down in the book, it doesn't really get included in the main text,
which is funny because it's an author making the decision to not tell these characters stuff about.
So the love story between Aragorn and Arwen is like hinted at, and then they're like, oh yeah, you're going to be like the modern Beren and Lothian, or whatever they're called. The previous elf/man couple that there was.
Yes.
This is the new one. And you're like, well, how did that happen? And in the appendix, you find out like how they met, you know, their meet cute.
Yes.
Which is quite fun. It's like a fun love story kind of setup there. Yeah.
And it wasn't worth putting in the main book.
If Aragorn had told that full story, or if somebody had told that full story to Frodo or Sam or Bilbo, it would have been included. There would have been a place to be included. So In the Return of the King, there's this whole adventure that Gimli and Legolas and Aragorn go on. They go through these caves of death or paths of death, and they get these. This is in the extended version of the movie,
right?
And they go and find the army of the dead, and the army of the dead goes and helps them take over the ships, and then they sail the ships up the river, and then come in and save the day at this final battle. They set off on that journey, and then it's kind of forgotten about, and suddenly they turn up. You know, it's meant to be like a twist, or like, what are these ships coming up? Oh, they've got Aragorn's flag on them, rather than the evil Southrend's flag, and they come out. And then later they're like, yeah, we did this, and we did this, and we're like, oh, that's... Now we get that told. Mm. Now we hear about that as it was told to the hobbits.
Right. Makes sense. Yeah.
So you definitely got to think about that. Ah, the stuff that we find out about in Lord of the Rings is stuff that the hobbits have found out.
Mm-hmm.
And if the hobbits don't know the...
We don't get to know.
We don't get to know it, except in the Silmarillion or in the appendices.
Right.
So it's sort of like later additions to the book, the Red Book of Westmarch or whatever.
And I think in a way, this adds to this whole idea of that this isn't just an author writing a book. This is... It adds to the idea of history and archives and like how things get lost in history and things get added on and people's ideas get added on.
Yeah, and that's what I really appreciate, and also what gives this so much depth, and what also keeps this book relevant in terms of like YouTube videos about the fan theories about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because the authors are dead. Like, literally, the author is dead. But also, if you think the author is dead, then you've just got the text of what it is, or maybe the stuff that the author has written about, bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Which means that then your theories are as good as any, because he's creating a playground for people to get into the weeds of this and go, well, what is this? Like, what powers do these gods have? What powers do these angels, well, not angels, but, you know, the Istari or the Maya or whatever they are?
Yeah.
Like, what level are we working on here, and how powerful are these people, and why do they do this and why do they not do that?
Yeah.
And so let me look at my notes to see what I...
You
want
to talk about
to...
wizards after my interruption.
My first note here is something from the podcast we recorded 2 days ago. Sean Bean, not in Death of Stalin. It's actually Jason Isaac who turns up. But because he's got a Yorkshire accent, in my memory, like an actor turning up and having a Yorkshire accent, it was just like, oh yeah, Sean Bean. That was Sean Bean. But it wasn't. I just misremembered who it was.
Right.
But the point that someone can turn up and just have a misplaced Yorkshire accent makes my mental snap to grid go, that must have been Sean Bean. Makes my point that Sean Bean turning up with a Yorkshire accent can throw off like an entire like realm of accents and like why people are using in this Death of Stalin, each one of the different people who turn up.
Yeah.
They're all like these, you know, Stalin's from here and, you know, from Georgia and this person's from out in the farmland and this person's from here and this person's from there. You
the
know.
Play on the biases that come with different accents.
Yeah, you're like, these are all just like working, like literally working class people who rose up and were union leaders and then became the head of the army. You're like, that explains more of the Bolshevik kind of stuff. Anyway, let's move on to wizards. So here's the thing. What I really liked is like discovering what wizards are in the Silmarillion.
Yeah.
But not, I mean, they're hardly mentioned in the Silmarillion.
Okay.
But the reason why wizards exist, which isn't very clear. Because when I've seen these, again, I've seen YouTube thumbnails saying, like, how powerful is Gandalf? And, like, why didn't Gandalf just do this? Or why didn't Gandalf just do this? It's explained within the Silmarillion why these people are needed. Because the Silmarillion is about so much of, like, hey, in the First Age, in the Second Age, Morgoth, who is, like, the Satan figure, who is like, at the the highest level of demigod. He was, like, the most, you know, like, Lucifer. Was God's favorite, but then he fell and he became the deceiver.
Yeah.
So that's Morgoth in the Silmarillion. And he fucked up the world so much. He fucked up the world so much that the main gods all had to come in and, spoiler alert, like capture him, tie him up in like, you know, cosmic chains and like throw him out to beyond the realms of Jupiter or whatever it is. You know, I don't know. I'm just like bringing stuff. But the cosmology is there. Like, this guy is now in chains. He's now in the void.
Yeah. He's so dangerous, the gods themselves had to take care of him.
Yeah, and they're like, right, sorted. No problem. Okay. Got it. Sorted. Got it. it. Got it. No problem at all. Got
but
it.
Now,
sorted.
But now people still live in the world that he...
Yeah, but Sauron is still there. Okay. And Sauron was like the next level down. He was like the best... he was like the next level angel, you know. So he was like, you know... well, I guess that's what Lucifer... Again, it's not. There's not a one-to-one matching up of like the overall creator god and then the demigods and then below them the angels or whatever. But anyway, so down at that next level, which is like an angel level, immortal, powerful being who can take on the form of a man or like as a man-shaped human form.
Yeah.
But that's not who they are.
Yes.
These people or these spirits can like take on the form of man or a human or an elf, but you know, like look like a physical being, but that's not actually who they are. They aren't that physical body, and that physical body can be killed, but their spirit lives on immortally. So the idea, and this is what the thing with Sauron is that like he's defeated and he's like recreating a body back over in the in Barad-dûr. And they're talking, and that's why he's never seen in the movie, because he hasn't taken on his
he hasn't got a body yet.
And so,
but he's powerful enough to like influence people with bodies and let them act on
his spirit
behalf.
Is still there, there is, he's still got like the eye, they're talking about the eye of Sauron in the movie. They actually make it into like this physical burning eye, which is like above this thing, which again, that's not how it is in the book. But you go, well, so that's how powerful he is. Gandalf is at the same level. He should be as powerful as Sauron. Also the Balrog, you know, the fire monster underground, that's also one of these
the same
spirits
level.
One of these spirits at the same level. So that's when Gandalf goes up against the Balrog, you're like, wait, he's just one guy with a sword and a staff, and his Balrog's got a whip and fire and flames. It's like, no, they're actually you know, equal level spiritually. But what happened is, so that at the end of the First Age, you're like, all the elves are like, fuck, we're really, you know, we really need to help with this Morgoth guy. Morgoth's put in the thing, and then Sauron takes over as the main evil, and there's other evils as well. There's like evil spiders, and there's evil Balrogs and the evil dragons, you know, other things which are like more powerful than elves but less powerful than the demigods,
right? Yeah.
And again, he fucks everything up, because Sauron is then the deceiver. He's like a real deceiver, and he tricks the elves into making rings, and he fucks up the elves. And then he also deceives the what's called the Numenor, which are the part elf human like man kings who are very, very powerful and are like,
but also easy to manipulate.
Well, they're just humans. They're
and also
they are very susceptible to power and like long life. These are mortals. They know that they're gonna live for maybe, because they've got this, you know, they've got the elf light in them or whatever it is, that they're gonna live longer than just, you know, the 70 or whatever it is. They're gonna not die at 70, they're gonna die at 150 or 200 or 300,
but they that's want, not enough for them
that's not enough for them, so they want longer life, and so they focus everything that they can on living longer and longer and longer, and any amount of power that they can have. That's why the nine rings to control the ring wraiths that they are, and the witch king, you know, the number one of the black riders, they're all these old Numenorean kings who were like given rings to be like, hey, be powerful, and just taken under Sauron. So Sauron was defeated in battle, but then instead of killing him or anything, they took him back to their main like capital city and were like, right, you're now a prisoner. And he very quickly worm-tongued his way into not being a prisoner, but actually being the advisor. And
but people never learn.
And he advised the Numenorean kings, what you should do is go over and attack, like, you know, Atlantis. Over, not Atlantis, because we're still on the Silmarillion map here.
Right.
They're like, head out on your ships and go and attack the elves and the Valar. Like, go and wage war on the demigods.
Right.
Go and wage war on the demigods, and that's where you've only been told that you can't be immortal.
Ah.
But if you go and fuck these guys up, Sauron tricks them into opening like another front on the war, and it goes so badly that the Valar, the gods, come in and destroy all of the stuff on the far side of the mountains.
By flooding it.
Yeah, all of this over here.
Yeah.
Where the Numenorean kings were, fucked up. That's now sunken. That's the flood coming in, and it just wipes it all away.
Okay.
And so what happens is Sauron dies in this attack as well, but he gets his body back and he starts getting, you know, back over into, you know, his space over here, Barad-dûr as well.
Yeah.
So he's still there. And this is now, the First Age and the Second Age has been fucked up so bad that the gods over there are like, we can't just keep leaving these elves and these men over there without any help.
Right.
They're not clever enough. They're not good enough. And they keep getting fucked up by first Morgoth and now Sauron.
Yeah.
They need some help and they need some guidance.
Oh, right.
So, but we don't want to just, like, but it has to be them who sort out their own land, because we can't be keep going backwards and forwards there. So let's now send over these five Istari, these five wizards, mm-hmm. to help them out.
So it's five of them.
Yeah. Only three of them are mentioned in the book, and only two of them mean anything at this point. Because they're each, as far as I can tell, again, if I read the Wikipedia page and went into all this other stuff, but they each had their own, like, main demigod leader person. Mm-hmm. So Gandalf is like fire, you know, he does all these fireworks and stuff and he's in power. Saruman is like about
water?
What's that?
Water?
No, not water. The two blue wizards are the water ones.
Oh, okay.
Saruman is like craft. He's like, making things.
Machining
and
stuff.
Making things.
Yes, yeah.
And Radagast is like nature. So it's all like trees and
Isn't
birds.
Isn't that the guy with the
Yeah, with I think he's
birds.
In like the Hobbit movie.
Yeah,
I think.
He's in the Hobbit movie.
So he's there and he's all into birds and trees and rabbits or whatever.
Right.
So they're sent over to advise men, but it says in the appendix of Lord of the Rings that they are told they can't go one, they can't just use their power against Sauron.
Mm.
They can't just expose all their power and just do everything by power.
Right.
They are told that you can't become powerful.
Mm.
You have to be advising and helping, but you can't just go, I'm the most powerful being here and take over.
Right.
Which is, again, what Saruman ends up wanting to do, because he gets deceived as well by Sauron.
Mm.
So that's the kind of setup, is that these five wizards, these Istari wizards, were sent over by the demigods, the Valar, and these are the Maia level, which is like this angelic level.
Right.
But there's also other beings there which are at that level.
Right.
For example, Sauron, the Balrog, Galadriel is like halfway between elf and there as well.
Right.
So Galadriel is like the most powerful elf, because she's like the daughter of a Maia, like wizard level, you know, angelic level, and an elf or something.
Yeah.
So she's like at that kind of level. That's why in the movie when she's sort of like Frodo is like, no, you should take the ring. She is like, no, because we'll get onto the ring a bit later. But anyway, so this is where the wizards are at that level of the wizards. And again, in the movie, you don't really get this. And even just reading the book, you don't really get like all of the levels of this. And what I really like about Lord of the Rings is that this is for you to discover, although if you just read the Silmarillion, it makes it a lot more clear what is going on.
Yeah.
But in so many, well, if you think about like the massive impact or the massive, like what Lord of the Rings did was like formulate these levels for all of fantasy from then on.
Yeah. And I think
and for like Dungeons and Dragons as well.
Yes.
The levels are literally, you level up.
Yeah.
You know, you go up from Hobbit to, you know, whatever the next power is, you know, whatever strength.
And what I like about this is basically you as the reader of any of this, you can decide how deep you want to explore these levels.
Yeah.
Like you can just read The Lord of the Rings and just be fine with it.
Well, I think the first level is just watch the movies Lord of the Rings.
Okay, yes, okay, yeah.
But no, that I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's the first level of understanding, but at the end of it, you have to watch YouTube videos to go, wait, what?
Yeah.
Who's Gandalf the Grey and who's Gandalf the White? Are they the same person? Like what's going on there?
Yeah, but if we're now just taking the books at their face value and the way that, like the books were there before the movies, so I'm concentrating on the books. So you can read, you can start reading at one point, and then depending on how you like it and how you want to know more, you like keep exploring in the different ways. You can read then The Hobbit, you can read the Silmarillion, you can read the appendices, you can you know, and I really like that idea of giving the reader options.
Yeah.
You know, they can explore more, but they also can just read the book and be like, oh, that was a fun adventure story.
But what I really enjoyed about reading it this time is having a little bit, again, this is my point going into this, was like, if I read the Silmarillion, I'm not going to be confused and these aren't going to be, well, I wouldn't say plot holes, but like, again, the Lord of the Rings, the novel, is the Hobbit's understanding of what's going on.
Yes.
But there is, but Tolkien understood a lot more and revealed it a lot more. And it's possible for you to come up with this. And this is, again, why I'm not interested. That's why I said when I finished The Silmarillion, I'm like, oh, this is in my head. And I said, I don't want to, you know, watch the other YouTube videos or read any other theories or what other people appreciate about this. Because it, for me, the fun exercise is to like just have this kind of idea, this framework in my head.
Yeah.
And then as I experience more Lord of the Rings, it's my reading of this. That's in there as well.
Yeah.
So here's the thing: during the previous book, you know, they go through the Mines of Moria, and Gandalf like sacrifices himself across the bridge of blah 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 blah, whatever it is, and then fights the Gandalf, and they drop, and in the movie he drops into a hole and disappears, and in the book he drops into a hole and disappears.
So in the story itself, up until this point, this is the first real big loss for them as a group, right?
Yeah, but they don't understand what Gandalf is.
No, of course they don't, because how would they? Did anybody tell them then?
That's the thing. I don't, like, the people there knew that Gandalf was a wizard.
Yeah.
And they probably knew
from fireworks.
But they weren't
sure
if he was a man or an elf, but he wasn't an elf because, you know, whatever. Either way, what it comes down to is that he has the same power as Sauron, which is that when he dies, he has a spirit which exists outside of him, and then he can take on the form of a man if he wants to. And that's why in the movie there's this confused thing where he comes back white.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, why is he white? It's like, oh, now he's, you know, he's taken over the lead role that Saruman had.
Yeah.
But now he's white. And then in the movie, they do a thing where you think it's Christopher Lee and they use the voice of Christopher Lee, but then it isn't his voice. And it's kind of, and it's like just confusing in the movie. And also in the book, it's confusing because they're like, yeah, and there was a wizard. And they're like, no, Saruman, you're the bad one. That's why we went through the Mines of Moria and we lost Gandalf, because we couldn't go through the Gap of Rohan because that's too close to, you know, Isengard. And we didn't want to come through here because that's your realm. So we went through the other way and we lost Gandalf. And now fight us because, you know, we hate you. And they're like, and after like pages of going through in the book, you know, and Andy Serkis is trying to do his best to do, like, you know, like in the movie, like, oh, is this Ian McKellen or is it Christopher Lee? So, and then it's like, oh, it's Gandalf. Oh, we didn't recognize you. And there's all this confusion in the book, and it's never explained that, yeah, but Gandalf he'd spent so long in the body of a man, like in a human looking body, that he had taken on the traits of a human and sort of grown old like a human,
right?
And his power had kind of wound down because he was so used to being in human world, land, whatever.
I see. So he was basically like, let's go an analogy here.
Yeah.
So if you're like a snake that hasn't shed its skin for a while, then it gets like slower and slower because, you know, it can't do the thing.
Yeah, and it sheds its skin, and the old skin is like smaller than its new skin.
Yes.
Or it's like those hermit crabs who like all line up move up a shell, and they're like, oh, I need a bigger shell. So that's, again, this is my reading of what's going on. But he's actually super powerful in that when he actually, again, in the book, it's like really explicit what's happening here is that when he dies and he defeats the Balrog, he's still a spirit. And he's looking around and going, well, what do I do now? Mm. And suddenly, over by the, you know, by the lake with the waterfall where Boromir is trying to get the ring and Frodo puts on the ring, the Eye of Sauron comes around and swings around and looks at him, and it's actually Gandalf's spirit which is like blocking him and saying, no, don't look here. And there's this battle of the wills between the not quite re-embodied spirit of Sauron and the completely not re-embodied spirit of Gandalf. There's like this cosmic battle going on above Frodo,
and they don't know about it.
And in the movie, it's just left out because it's too difficult to explain that. Because you're like, you know, no, Gandalf must have died, and we only find this out later. And so it's so much fun to go back and discover this in the book. It's like, oh, it's all there. Mm. There's this cosmic battle going on where Gandalf is has been sent over by the gods to become advisors and guiders and like an equal power balancing force or balancing power up against Sauron. And there's five of them, you know, five of these wizards to go up against them like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, but when he gets sent back to finish his job, you know, in a kind of like Christ-like figure, you know, die, resurrection, yes. take a trip to the underworld, go back up into heaven and then get sent back to Earth. I mean, it's like, you know.
Be not, white and light. Yeah, and yeah.
But what he does, he comes back with the power of pretty much all five of the Istari who aren't helping.
Right.
Like he becomes Gandalf the White and he takes on the power, like the powers that... certainly the power that Saruman had, he now has it. So he's kind of got like, he's like doubled up. He's like leveled up in the, you know, in the Dungeons and Dragons thing, you get to the end of the mission, you roll the dice and you go up from like level 10 to level 10, 12 or whatever, and you get more powers and you get more stuff. So he's now glowing and people look at him and going, holy shit, Gandalf. And like, he literally for the rest of the book, like I said before with the elves, he's just glowing for the rest of the book. Like there isn't any like, oh, is he the same guy? Gandalf, he's the same spirit, but now he's got a new body, he's got a new cloak, he's got a new white beard, which is white instead of grey, and he can remember stuff from his previous life, but like it comes back to him slowly.
Yeah, makes
sense. Yep. So yeah, and then later on when they finally get to Isengard, in the movie, it's like left out of the theatrical cut of the movie. The Ents come in and, you know, destroy...
The Ents are the walking trees.
Yeah, the trees. Yeah. So they come in and destroy Isengard.
Yes.
And then Saruman is then, like, left in that tower. Yeah. And in the theatrical version of the movie, he's just left out. He doesn't die. You just don't see him again.
Abandoned on top of a tower.
Yeah, you're just like, oh, let's assume that Saruman is defeated and that's it, and they move on. And in the extended version, at the start, which is like the worst part, like literally the worst part of any of those movies, is the additions to the, like in the extended version of the final movie, the Return of the King. Because it starts off with Sméagol turning up, like Gollum, but pre-Gollum Gollum.
Yeah.
And it's Andy Serkis, but he's doing Smeagol's voice.
Yes.
And he's doing Gollum's voice. So I'm like, he was just like one of the river folk, one of the river hobbits.
Yeah.
But he's like, no, give it to me, my precious. And I'm like, no, back then he was like, the ring made him say my precious.
Yes.
Like, anyway, but apparently he was already quite kind of like a bad hobbit. He was already a nasty hobbit.
Yeah.
So sure, whatever. But then like the worst special effect with the hobbit underwater getting the ring. And so I'm like, that's the worst green screen I've ever seen. And then there's the whole scene where the hobbits, like Merry and Pippin, are drinking the wine and like getting taller.
Yeah.
You remember that in the movie? That's like this Ent juice that's in the book. It's more.
In
the book, they get taller. And then for the rest of the time, when people, other hobbits see them, they're like, wow, you're tall. And then they get home and everyone's like, wow, you're tall. You must be the hero. So when they get home at the end of the book, Merry and Pippin are classed as the main heroes. And Sam and Frodo, who haven't got any taller, they're just thought, well, I guess you went along on the adventure with Merry and Pippin.
That's very funny.
So they grow, these hobbits grow taller.
But only two of them.
Only two of them, and only in that one scene. And then the rest of the time when they're standing next to Sam and Frodo, they're the same height because they just didn't... It's like annoying to suddenly have a different scale.
Yes.
And then bad green screen, Saruman on the top, he falls down onto this spiky wheel of death, which I understand what they're doing because in the shower, it's scouring of the Shire. At the end, there's this mill, you know, there's mill wheel. Yeah, I understand that he dies... But it doesn't make any sense and it's not in the book and it's just terrible.
And now let's get away from the movies again.
Yeah.
So what happens to Saruman?
Well, what happens is that Gandalf comes back and saying, you don't have any power anymore. Your body now no longer has your Maiar spirit, your Istari spirit. You are now just a man.
And
so you and Wormtongue are harmless pretty much.
Right.
So you don't have any power, and Gandalf is now got the combined power of Gandalf and, I mean, it's not like he's got the combined power, but he's like, he's leveled up, and
he's
at the same
up,
time
and
he's
then
leveled
he has,
up.
He has the ability to strip one of them
and
from...
And Saruman has been leveled down.
Yes,
so
okay,
it's like you
sense.
Were sent over here to balance out Sauron's power. If you go over and become evil like Sauron, you're not doing your job.
Yes.
We remove your power and Gandalf gets more power to help
makes
out
sense.
In this way.
I have one really, really pressing question here.
Yeah.
If you have something where you want to balance something out, why would you get an odd number of it?
an odd number of it.
Why would you get five wizards? Well, it's, instead
look,
of
each one of the gods gets to send one of their guys over. There's lots of just imagine like trying to keep in line like Thor and you know whatever the other you know not
just,
Thor
just
like
look at Zeus yeah.
yeah Zeus and all of it. It's like they're not like they've each got their own way of looking at things yeah. and their own desires and their own realms. You know yeah. there's the sea person, there's the you know the underground
the
fire
air
person, there's the air person, yeah. there's the nature person. Yeah. You know they've all got their own gigs going on.
Yes.
So when they send people over, but they're told like you can't go power for power. You can't all just combine all five of you and just go and get rid of Saruman. It's sort of like because he's also, they're all immortal.
Mm.
So Saruman, the only reason why Saruman is actually finally killed is because he put his power into a ring.
He overstepped.
Yeah, he overstepped. He put his power into a ring, and if you destroy the ring, he's destroyed.
Yeah.
But the other ones, it doesn't work that way. Mm. You know, like other immortal beings, it doesn't quite work that way.
Mm.
So you can't just go and kill the guy,
yeah.
but you've got to go and stand up against him and make sure you are the correct, kind, wise advisor, good advisor to balance out the evil advice that Sauron will give.
Right. Yes. Okay.
Knowledge. And they have the Palantir, which are these stones, these round stones that you look into.
Yeah.
And they're like ansibles where you can like long distance communication. And there were seven of them. And so whenever you looked into them, you could see what the other people were seeing in these other times.
Yeah. Where the other thing was.
Yeah. And that, and those Palantirs are these, it pretty much television, far-sighted yeah. things is what it means.
Yeah.
So, and Sauron has one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also one one of the Minas Morgul, which is where, like, another orc witch king kind of person has
yeah.
one. And then they're like, well, there's seven of them, and we know where two of them are. And the other ones are like, Sauron is using them. You know, he kind of reveals them or gives them to other people and say, hey, here's a Palantir. But again, sneakily, because he's yeah. all like deceiver.
Don't show anyone.
Don't show anyone. Saruman has one looking in there and going, yeah. oh, I can see what Saruman is doing, but I won't say him like that. And then you're like, I could be like Saruman. You know, that's kind of thing. He yeah. slowly deceives some stuff. So it's one of those weird things that Sauron is like using these Palantirs, and he does the same thing. You know, the Mad King in Minas Tirith,
yeah.
in the third, who throws himself on the fire? Mm-hmm. He's got a Palantir. He's been deceived by, you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
been
yeah.
tricked by that. He knows what's going on. He's like seen as very wise.
Yeah.
And it's not very wise. It's like he's being fed information
yeah.
by Sauron.
Yes.
And knows what's going on and knows that Saruman is turning evil yeah. as well, and knows that like all the enemies are on his gate.
Yeah. I was always really, really confused. It took me ages like yeah. watching the movies
yeah.
to differentiate Sauron and Saruman and
yeah.
like to get a grasp of yeah, who is who.
Arwen,
and
Eowyn. It's like, come on, just give them slightly different names. But then, yeah, like they're linked in a way, and it's like literary and
yes.
and the root words are the similar kind of things. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, it would be really handy if Saruman wasn't called Saruman and Sauron and Saruman and Sauron. It's like, oh, come on. But in the end, it is all like bad guys begin with S,
yeah.
end with on. Saruman, Sauron.
So wizards.
So Saruman locks himself away from the world and is depleted and stripped of his powers by Gandalf. Or Gandalf like announces what's happened. Again, it's not really clear in the book. It's sort of like, because a lot of these wizards, it's sort of like the will. It's sort of like how much force of will that you have.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing where he says, like across the bridge with the Balrog coming up, it's he has to state what his will is.
Yeah.
You cannot pass, or you will not
pass.
You shall not pass. I don't know. There's different.
I don't know what he says in the book.
Yeah, yeah. I think it says you cannot pass. It's sort of like you're going to try and get past me, but you cannot get past me.
Mm-hmm.
And the Balrog isn't interested in getting past. But you know, there's whatever is going on there. You know, there's these different levels going on. But yeah, all of this stuff is really fun. And in the Silmarillion, a lot of this stuff is like not explained, but there's enough of the cosmology or theology or mythology there to
yeah.
kind of explain what goes on in the books more clearly than the books explain themselves. So
yeah.
that's why I think this is a great payoff of reading the Silmarillion and then going into Lord of the Rings. Everything is a little bit more clear, like, okay, what level are we working on now? I thought Saruman was the main thing, and then Tom Bombadil, and you're like, oh, Tom Bombadil is probably like, you know, again, halfway between one of these things, you know.
Okay, but he's not a wizard.
He's not a wizard, but he's not affected by the ring, but Gandalf is tempted by the ring. Or Gandalf is worried about being tempted by the ring, and Saruman is very much. So Tom Bombadil is at the next level up, that the ring doesn't hold any power over him, and he can see through the ring and isn't worried about it. So yeah, I think he's more of that Valar kind of level, who just happens to be existing next to Hobbiton, or next to the Shire.
Right.
So, let's talk about Ents. Well, we're talking about the Shire, because the Ents...
The big tree people.
The big tree people. The oldest beings, because before the elves were created, or the elves were woken up, the dwarves and the Ents were created by...
Oh, the dwarves and Ents are the same time frame.
Here's the thing. Everyone knew that elves, that the main god, Iluvatar, whatever his name is, was going to make two sets of peoples to people his land. The immortal elves...
Yeah.
And the mortal humans.
Yes.
And the other gods, these demigods, are like, we want some people of our own.
We want something to play with.
And so the tree goddess is like, I'm going to make Ents. I'm going to make these tree people to look after the trees. And the underground smith, you know, craftsperson god, who was the husband of the tree goddess, is like, I'm going to make these elves, and they're going to like need, you know, they're going to...
Elves.
Dwarfs, and they're going to do it. But they did them too early. And so the main god is like, hey, no, these guys, sure, they can exist, but they're not allowed to wake up before the elves.
I see.
They're created and put to sleep, and then they only wake up again. What it means that the elves wake up or the men wake up? It's left very fuzzily. But anyway, but so the Ents, each main forest has its main Ent.
Right.
So Treebeard is actually, his real name is Fangorn, and he's like he's actually the spirit embodiment of the entire forest.
Right, yes.
And it's not just the Ents that can move, it's like there's all of these half Ents, which used to be Ents, but over time they lose their, like they become more and more tree-like.
Yeah.
But at the
it's
end,
the same kind of thing. The longer you don't use any of your skills, you're just gonna just lose.
But the thing is, there's a big problem with the Ents.
Yeah.
Is that they've lost their wives, because the wives lived on the other side of the river.
Aww.
There was all these the Ent wife nurseries that they had.
Like the female trees.
Yeah, the female trees. And they're like, yes, we've kind of mislaid them. We've lost them. We don't know where they are. They went somewhere. No. We don't know. But what's really funny in the book is that Treebeard is like, wait, you're from the Shire. Tell me about the Shire. And he's like, because they're talking about like this old man Willow, which is up in, like there's other forests around the Shire.
Right.
And he's like, but the Shire seems very nice and very like regimented. He's sort of like, I reckon the Shire is so nice because it's actually...
It's part of it's all the women trees.
The Ent wives are up there.
Aww.
And I was like, I really like that. Of course, it's explained why the Shire can be so nice and be like all civilized and, you know, very much like, you know, nice parts of like Surrey or whatever it is. Where the rest of the world is like savage and it's because the rangers are up there, you know, Aragorn and the other leftover Dúnedain or whatever.
Yeah.
The rangers are up there, and anyone who comes up there, like, kill the orcs, kill the southern people, kill these other people. So, and in the book, it's really clear that as soon as the rangers from the north, like Aragorn's no longer there, the Shire gets fucked up. You know, this, you know, they get
run over.
They get overrun pretty quickly.
But the people living in the Shire, they have no idea.
Yeah,
they just live like...
But they know that there's elves in the forest around them.
Yeah.
And they also, and then Tom Bombadil is next door, and then the rangers are next door.
Yeah,
so
which is very handy.
They've got this massive buffer zone. They've got Tom Bombadil, they've got elves, they've got the rangers, and they've got a big expanse, like this big empty expanse to the south. So.
And then it makes sense that they don't have to live to become warriors or be defending anything.
No.
They can just enjoy their lives.
Yeah,
and
this tiny... If you look at this big map here, the Shire... is this bit here.
Oh, this is tiny.
Yeah. Like, one second. Let me, if I zoom in here, you can get there. And in the start of the book, they get from, this is the Brandywine Bridge. So this is where, this is the old forest here as well.
Right.
So yeah, it takes them a few days to get across from Hobbiton to here.
Mm.
And then another week to get to there.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually see how big the Shire is. Mm. It's just this like tiny little bit here.
Yeah.
So, and this is the West March. The Red Bug arrest West March is like, this is where it's from here.
Yeah.
So, it's this tiny little pocket. And for them, it's like a big thing. The Shire, we walk across the Shire. It takes us 2 days to walk across the Shire. And literally like months later, they're trucking across Mordor going, wow, we've come a long way. So, yeah, you really have.
Yeah.
What else was I going to say? So yeah, Ents. In the movie, the Ents are like, I don't think we're going to do anything. And then it's only when Merry and Pippin like take him and like, go south, we'll see how Isengard is like chopping down the trees.
They are coming to destroy you.
Yeah. And it's sort of like, it's a moment for Merry and Pippin to show Treebeard what's going on. Yeah. And then they call him in the book, it's like, no, the Ents are like, we need to go and fuck up Saruman because he keeps chopping down trees on the edge of the forest and we can't lose any more of a forest.
Yeah.
So we're on our way to fuck up Saruman, and the Good. Ents just do it. They say, we've been sitting in our forest for the last two ages of men, like, or whatever it is, like, elves know that we're here, but men are like, don't really know about us because we just kind of sit around and talk to each other. And so it's really funny that in the movie, it's all like, because they want to make our fellowship members, you know, more important. But I think the main theme of this second book is sort of like, shit's going down, even if the hobbits aren't there.
Yeah.
You know, and if Aragorn isn't there and Gimli and Legolas isn't going there, all of this stuff that was happening over here, it was all going to happen anyway. Like this shit was going to go down and they just happened to be here.
I quite like the dichotomy, or like the difference between, I know they're not in the same level, but like the elves, the way that you describe them as beings is very indifferent, and like they are immortal. They don't have to care. They can just, you know, say, you do you, and we don't have to engage with any of this stuff. And the Ents, they have been sitting around for a long time.
The Ents are older than the elves, is what they're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Fangorn, Treebeard is the oldest being in Middle Earth, is what
they
say.
Which I find very charming to think about trees this way, because it's true. Like trees around us, some trees are so old, they lived through several kind of human-induced cruelty and wars, and they are all just hanging on and are still there. And I really like the idea that trees can just at some point get so fed up by what's going on around them.
We're gonna do this,
okay guys, we sat around for a long time now, we thought you might be able to sort out any of your shit, now is the time.
You haven't done it.
We're fed up.
Yeah.
We have to get...
See here on this map, Fangorn is here and the Entwives' gardens are here.
Oh, it's not that far away.
No, they were just the other side of the river. Oh. And, you know, the great greenwood was there and these other things were there. And this is where the Entwives were. This is all Ent country around here.
Right.
But yeah, it's a weird one. So let's move on. And remember, I wanted to talk about battles. Now, in this other podcast that I listened to after we did our podcast about the Silmarillion, this Meal of Thorns podcast, which I was going to look up who the people were. Jake Casella is the main host. And again, I can't remember who the guest was. I said I was going to look it up to talk about it here so I could name the guy.
You're so useless.
Oh, I don't know. I am so useless. So they were talking about what they didn't like about, or what they thought that Peter Jackson missed about the Lord of the Rings. Is that in the Lord of the Rings, battles are sideshows to the main thing.
Right.
But because battles are the main thing, some of the most dramatic things that you can put on screen for a movie, they suddenly become the main focus of... They suddenly can be the main focus.
And become a trap by being that.
Yes.
I think.
And they also had this great line, which is like in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields. I can't remember what they said. It's fun because, you know, Gimli's out there doing it, but, you know, killing stuff. And they said that, what was it, Legolas, like, no scope 360 is an Oliphant. It's not like, yeah. So, again, there's fun stuff can happen in these battles.
Yes.
But I would like to give a defense of battles, but also sieges. In fact, let me talk about the difference between fights, sieges, and battles.
Okay.
Because at the end of the first movie, end of Fellowship of the Rings, there's a fight. And it's not a full-on battle because, you know, Boromir is there getting shot by arrows and Aragorn comes in and fucks up some orcs.
Mm-hmm.
Or not orcs, in this case, the Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
And the which are the orcs which are crossed with men who can...
Just warrior orcs.
They're the big warriors, so they're bigger than orcs and can run around around in the daylight and not they don't mind being out in the daylight.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
other orcs really dislike the daylight.
Yeah.
They're much more like underground and nighttime kind of things. Mm. But these Uruk-hai, so the fight at the end is really, really good. Like, you know, Sean Bean, spoiler, dying in a movie is really effective.
Oh, yeah, it's very
And Aragorn very going up against this Uruk-hai. Mm. Again, in the book, it's sort of like, no, Aragorn and Boromir are like the most amazing fighters and they just like come in and everyone slays.
Yeah.
And they and as soon as the orcs get the hobbits and run away, they're like, fuck, Aragorn and Boromir behind it, whatever. But, so Boromir has to be killed by arrows because he's just too good of a fighter to survive anyway. But in the movie, I actually really appreciate the movie wrapping up with that bit. And then, because that's where the book ends, but they kind of make sure that we understand, like, that, you know, everybody
the
knows
severity.
That the severity of it. Yeah. And they're like, and now the fellowship splits up. And it's, and I really, really appreciate how they heighten the action at the end of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, the movie.
Yeah.
I think the end of that is actually better than the book.
Okay.
In some ways.
Yeah.
Again, the book is good, but I really... That's why I think that Fellowship of the Rings is like the best movie by far of the three of them.
Oh, yeah.
Is because it wraps up in this way where two guys go in this direction, two guys have gone in that direction, captured, and the other three guys are like, let's go and fight them. And there's been like two rounds of loss and mourning for Gandalf, and now Boromir's gone, and we're like down to just seven of the original nine.
Really, like reduced.
And it's really, really good. So that's a fight, which is carry on.
And I think what really is important here to say is that this fighting.
Yeah.
First, Gandalf with the
Balrog.
That's a fight.
Yeah.
And then the more like human people.
Yeah, human level fighting.
They then
yeah.
have to fight and it's hard and they don't win and it's important and meaningful.
Yes.
Right? And it doesn't go on and on and on. It's it's a contained thing and it ends and then that's it.
Well, put it this way. It is the climax of action.
Yes.
So a fight happens.
Yeah.
Like they fight a troll in Moria and then they do lots of running and there's lots of action. There's like climbing and jumping and running.
Fighting
and
the troll. Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, fight. There's, so that's like some of the main like fighty, battle-y kind of like act. But it's action.
Yes.
And action in itself is really good fun.
Yeah.
Action is fun.
Yeah.
Like having desperate people trying to achieve something which is slightly outside of their grasp is what like action is in a movie.
Yeah.
If it's too easy for them, it's just stuff happening.
And also because we get to know that, you know, these guys are our protagonists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But don't you think you're safe?
Yeah, don't
Any
think
of
yeah,
these
yeah, yeah.
guys can just, you know, disappear, die or whatever. And I think this is important because it shows that just because they're protagonists, we don't follow along and everybody always knows, oh, they're going to be fine.
They have plot armor. So I think this the movie establishes that not all of these characters have plot armor.
Yeah.
And plot armor means that if you're the main character, you'll be safe as long as the plot wants you to be safe.
Yeah.
So that's action and fights. So a fight can be a part of the action. So then there's a battle. And a battle is generally power on one side and power on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, determined by what the plot needs to happen, one side wins or one side doesn't win.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
And then there's a siege, and a siege is we are outnumbered and this is a slog. Now here's the thing. In the movie, the Helm's Deep sequence is probably one of my favorite ever siege scenes in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is so good. Like, it's great.
See all the suffering, all the kind of
the wall
like,
doesn't make sense.
Means.
The tower doesn't make sense. The stronghold, like why they're there. Like in the movie, it makes sense for the movie why they're there, and it's a slog. Although the elves turn up, which I disagree with, because then all the elves are killed, and I'm like, that was a waste. These guys are like way too powerful here.
Yeah.
But what happened is apparently in the first draft of the movie, they had Arwen go down, elf princess go down with some elves to help out with the fight there.
Yeah.
And then they had all these elves there that they'd filmed and they're like, well, we can't edit all of those out. So they still left in this scene of these elves turning up, helping with the fighting. They all die and their contribution was literally meaningless.
Yeah.
And then more and more people die and, you know, all this kind of good stuff. And there's this really great thing where Gimli and Legolas
have, you know, this fun.
They're counting, and I thought watching the movie, I'd forgotten that that's in the book. That's clearly
actually in the book.
Yeah, yeah. It's this really fun moment in the book where they're like, "I've killed four," and Legolas is like, "I've killed six," and then they're like, "I'm up to 12. Oh, I'm only on 11." And in the end, it's so clear in the book that Legolas has destroyed Gimli. His total is like so much higher. And Gimli says, "I've got 22. And Legolas says, "I've got 21. You've beaten me by one." And I'm like, Legolas, my heart melts. Your bromance aww, going on here. Aww. Like your friendship that's developing
is
here.
It's more meaningful to you.
It's so meaningful that you obviously absolutely trounce Gimli, but you're going to let Gimli have this win.
Aww.
Anyway,
nice.
Lots of fun stuff happens in the battle. Legolas is sliding on his shield down the wall, and you do
in the
this
book
kind
as
of,
well.
No. No, in the book. No, see, the thing, what I'm saying is this scene is probably one of the best ever sieges, like last things. And then I remember watching the movie in the theater, and Gandalf is like, "Look for me on the look towards morning on the third day." It's another, like, you know, "I rise on the morning of the," like another Jesus kind of thing. He comes back and he leads the other riders who were down in the South Mark. He the South Mark riders or whatever it is.
Yeah.
He brings them all up. Or the West Mark. I can't remember. Either way. Whichever. He brings the other riders and the sun comes up. He's on the white horse. He's on the, you know, the Lord of Horses.
Symbolism after symbolism.
And there's sunlight comes up and they all race down the hill and all the orcs are like, "No!" And then the forest has moved up and they run into the forest and the forest is like, "Gulp!" And they're like... And it's so good that... It takes up, it sucks so much energy away from the rest of the meaningful part of the story.
Yeah.
That they actually, you see in the behind the scenes stuff, they're like, weren't the Ents, they're meant to destroy Isengard, aren't they? Okay, let's build a model. And they're like really rushed. They've got to build this model and then destroy it in 6 weeks and then put in the CGI Ents and stuff. And they're like really rushed because they spent so long over in Helm's Deep.
Yeah.
At the Bergheim or the Berghelm or whatever, I can't remember the name of the tower there. Probably not Bergheim. Berghain. No,
wouldn't
not that.
Be funny.
I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
The tower, one of the tower that's there. And it's just a massive part of the movie, which is so good, but also isn't in the book.
Oh.
In the book, that is not a siege.
Okay.
They don't get all of the people of Rohan, all of the horse people.
Yeah.
They don't get them all there into that thing and try and save them.
Yeah.
This is not a last stand in the book.
Oh.
What they do is that Theoden and Éomer, who's like his nephew.
Yeah.
Eowyn's
so the
brother,
the king of Rohan.
The guy. In the movie, he's played by, I don't know, the guy. It doesn't matter. Either
yeah,
way,
the guy.
The nephew.
Yeah.
Who becomes king later
on.
Them two and like Aragorn look at a map and go, right, where's the best place to fuck up these orcs?
So it's basically
they decide to go there because that's the best place to take the fight.
Yeah.
It's halfway between their home. It's halfway between their, you know, their wooden horse hall.
Yeah.
And it's halfway between there and Isengard. Then, like, if we get there, we can meet there.
Okay.
And also, that's one of our main strongholds.
Okay, makes
which was
sense.
Built by the Numenoreans or the whatever it is. And it was given to us by the Gondor. It's like a Gondor castle. It's not a horse person castle. It's a Gondor castle, which was given to them.
Okay. So it's like a clever strategic move
in
so war
like, that's
where
the best
you
place
say,
to go.
Okay, where can we decide... Like, we take the battle there. This is where we have our strong thing.
And you find out in the appendix that it's called Helm's Deep because one of their kings was called Helm. Mm. And that's where he fought a big battle and won or died or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, so they're like, that's a great place. We'll go down there. We'll take over the castle. We've got loads of provisions there if we need it.
Yeah.
The orcs will come. We'll go out there and fuck up the orcs.
Yeah.
And guess what happens in the book? That's what happens. They go down there, and of course, there is sacrifice. People die, and then the trees come out and help them out and swallow up the rest of the thing.
Yeah.
In the movie, there's no humans. They're only fighting against these orcs or these Uruk-hai.
Yeah.
In the book, all of the Rohan were given that land to them by Gondor as a buffer place. They're
makes
sense. You can have this place in case there's, you know, you can be like a buffer
and
nation.
It's such a good battle place because you have a long... Is that in the book as well? You have a long, big, open area where people, like, if your enemy comes towards you...
Yeah, you can just shoot at them from different directions. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
and you
here's
are
the thing.
Up there.
In the book, it's just a way to show that Théoden is a good king.
Yeah.
Éomer, his nephew, is a great fighter. Mm. Strikes up a fantastic, like,
good
again,
strategist.
Like, he's just a good king. Yeah. Aragorn comes in, helps them out strategically. Mm-hmm. Gimli and Legolas, they're doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, sallying forth and doing stuff and getting, like, covered by, you know, in bodies of orcs or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in the book, it's like, yeah, we're just there and we're going to win this battle. And they do sacrifice and it is bad. But in the movie, it's a last stand. Mm. And they have to wait for Gandalf to come in. In the book, Gandalf literally says, "Don't expect me back again."
Right.
And they don't. He does come back.
But they don't expect him.
They don't expect him. When he comes back, it's all like, well, you were handy, but we kind of had this wrapped up anyway. And then the trees came in and we were going to be fine.
We were fine.
So in the movie, it becomes this last stand where Aragorn, like, everyone's dying and the women and children are back there, like, only barely hanging on. Yeah. They're coming through and
I really didn't like that bit.
And then they have this really dumb moment. Well, not dumb moment. It's a triumphant moment, but it's timed perfectly that Aragorn says to Théoden, "Ride out with me one last time." And it's this amazing moment in the movie. In the book, it's the opposite. Théoden says to Aragorn, like, "Should we go out once more? Like, we can do this. Like, if we go out now, you and me and Éomer, we go out there on our horses, we can win this battle." And they do. And it's so crazy that this is sort of like one chapter in the book. Mm. And it's like a third of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's so good that in the next movie, they're like, "Let's do that again." Twice more. And I'm like, no. But here's the thing. The real siege in Lord of the Rings is the siege of Minas Tirith.
Yes.
Is the White Tower down on the plains with the forest, with the river going past, and there's Osgiliath, you know. Again, the geography is a bit confusing.
Down there.
Yeah, yeah. It's let's bring it over here. So it's down here on these on the Pelennor Fields or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
In the book, that's the desperate siege. Mm. That's the siege which is so desperate that the king decides to burn himself because everything is so desperate. That's the siege where they send all women and children and old men out of the city in advance, and they send them all out because they know that that's where, like, the hordes are going to come from the east, the people are going to come up from the south, there's going to be other people from, you know, other enemies coming in. That's the main desperate siege. Mm. But because in the movie, they've already done a desperate siege. That becomes more of a, like, just a big battle where, again, they're just waiting around for the relief armies to turn up to save them.
Yeah.
And so it feels like these big sacrifices that are made just waiting around for the relief army, the surprise relief armies to turn up.
Yeah.
Is done in Helm's Deep, and then it's done in the Pelennor Fields, where the surprise army that turns up, I mean, the Riders of Rohan turn up, but then the army of the dead turn up and come out of the ships and like drag down the Oliphants and stuff.
Yeah.
And then later on, up at the Black Gates, there's another desperate, let's just charge at the enemy for no reason and just hope that something happens, and then the relief is that the ring is destroyed and that they do it. So, like, you did this three times. It works so well in the movie for Helm's Deep to be that way. Mm-hmm. But it's Helm's Deep sucks the life and the drama out of all of the other possible battles that should be happening.
Yeah. Like storytelling wise.
Yeah.
You just already shot all your bullets out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you've shot your load.
Click, click, click.
Yeah, and then you click, 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 and then Pelennor Fields come along. And here's the thing. It works in the book that Legolas and Gimli can have their joking around, "I've killed 21, or, well, I've killed 22, or whatever it is. It works in the book because they're just fucking up some orcs. Mm. It isn't desperate. It isn't a last stand. It's just a battle which they are expecting to win because they're like, we are taking the fight to Saruman. Mm-hmm. And we have to do this now because he's getting more powerful, and we need to defeat this enemy over here on our west before we turn back to the east and go and help out over there. Mm-hmm. So let's finish up this fight and then we can turn around and go back over there."
Yeah.
And, you know, it is fun that the Ents come and help, or, you know, the forest, like, moves itself around and swallows up the orcs. But really, it's okay for them to be laughing and joking about how many they kill because...
Yeah, it's like the comic relief. Yeah. At that point, you know...
It's okay. In the book, they are the comic relief keeping track and Legolas giving Gimli a fake win because he wants him to be his boyfriend or whatever. Yeah.
Just his friend. It doesn't matter what he is.
In the appendix of Lord of the Rings, it said that there's never been such a friendship between a dwarf and an elf ever before.
Okay.
And that they're such good friends and they love each other so much that when Legolas heads over to the Western Isles when he retires from Middle Earth and goes over to go and live in, you know, Mount Olympus, Gimli comes with him.
Aww.
And there's this explanation, which is all like, oh yeah, Gimli just wanted to see Galadriel again. But it's like, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They're a couple by that time.
Nice.
They've gone on adventures together. Yeah. They've done this whole thing. Again, this is just my reading. This is my reading. And I know, of course, all the fan fiction is about how much Sam and Frodo love each other. But I'm not so sure about that. Like, that's just, you know, master servant. That's like friendship. But here's the thing. In the book, Legolas and Gimli, they always want to ride together on the same horse. And I'm like, does it always need to be those two on the same horse? No, they're very insistent that they always ride on the same horse together.
I like that. It's
and
good.
Go on an adventure together.
It's totally...
Anyway, so what happens is that then in the movie, they just continue on that, I've killed 15, you've killed 13, and when Legolas takes down the whole Oliphant and Gimli says, that's still just one. Great line in the movie. But at that point in the book, that's really desperate. And also Gimli and Legolas aren't even mentioned in the book during that whole battle because they're just off to the side.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's one of these weird things is that the movie version of Helm's Deep is so good that it sucks the life out of everything. But it works in the movie.
Yeah, visually. And
but
like
it means we don't have time in that movie for a proper showdown with Saruman. We could have like wrapped up Saruman's story there, but we don't have time. We could have like spent more time with like Sam and Frodo should have been fighting a big spider at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
The action beat at the end should have been Shelob with Sam and Frodo going up against Shelob and you end with Sam thinking Frodo has been killed by the spider and he has to take the ring. That's how the book ends. Sort of like Sam is now, I'm now the ring bearer.
Yeah.
I'm going to take the ring and complete this because Frodo has died.
And also that's really important because that is more loss.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you keep going along.
It's worked.
Like Gandalf and Boromir and then...
But you want to end on the win. And the win is Gandalf coming down the mountain and the Ents going and destroying Isengard.
Yeah.
That is the win that they wanted to end the movie with. And it makes it into a better movie, but it makes the next movie...
So much harder.
So much worse because you've got to put too much in there or you've got to cut too much out.
Yeah.
So we don't get Saruman's whatever. The action with the spider isn't there. And then the Pelennor Fields battle and the Minas Tirith battle, again, sucks the life out of the rest of it when, again, in the book, that's very important, but actually what's important is what's going on with the king up in the tower and what's going on with, you know, other stuff.
Yeah.
But the battles and the sieges are switched in. The Pelennor Fields should have been the last stand desperate battle. And they could have made it work where you didn't go to the Black Gates, that Frodo destroys the army as they needed to around there. Or you could have, again, there's ways to have make it work.
I think what happened with the movies is that they started out looking really at all the canon, everything.
Again,
had
we
to
mentioned
be
this in the previous podcast. They just didn't have time in the third one.
Yes, but also I think that's where they fell over their own feet because they wanted to be as close to the original texts as possible, and then that was in the books. So they thought, oh, we had to put it in, and the artistic decision that would have to be made, for example, with the Black Gate, that wasn't necessary at
all. It is one of those things that, like, it would be diminishing, but I think if they'd have made the call, which is, let's have the Battle of Pelennor Fields, let's have Aragorn not go on his adventure to find the people of the dead.
Yeah.
Let's have a big last stand there.
Yeah.
And let's have Aragorn, because Aragorn has one of the Palantir things. If he looks into there and tells, because he goads Sauron and says, look, we're coming for you. Mm. And he does that to get the attention away from Mordor,
to get Frodo going.
They could have just done that
as he approaches. And let it work.
Yeah.
For the movie's sake, it would have been so much better.
He could have done that on the trip through the Deads, and he could have said, I am controlling this army of the dead.
Yeah.
Like, come at me. I've got the ring. Come at me. And yeah. then it could have all come together at Minas Tirith or Gilead or the Pelennor Fields. They could have done it there. And it isn't how it is in the book, but it would have taken out an entire extra battle that we didn't need.
Yes.
And it meant we could have, you know, the movie could have started. Well, it kind of does with the Shelob kind of stuff. Anyway, there's more to have done there.
Anyway, too many battles diminish the meaning of it.
Yeah, so there's my difference. Sieges can be good, but I think sieges have to be desperate last stands is how a siege should be.
Yeah.
But an open battle, you can't have a desperate last stand or a desperate last moment in an open battle unless it's very explicitly we're sacrificing ourselves here, which they do at the Black Gates. In the book, it's explained a bit better. And in the movie, it's sort of like, why are they around there again? And then it's just all green screened and it's just not very good.
Yeah.
The geography doesn't work out very well. But so there's my stuff about battles. Anyway,
so this is the section about wizards and Ents and battles.
The next bit I was going to talk about, which is book four, which is I mostly wanted to talk about Gollum and the power of the ring. But we've got an hour and 10 minutes here. So I just want to say the audiobook narrator is Andy Serkis. And this is the part where he just gets to be Gollum for even longer than he is in the movie.
In that section.
It's actually really good fun. And I really like the... Let me put it this way. The ring... fucks you up and also makes it so you don't actually have to eat or sleep or do anything. Like the longer you have it, the more power it transfers to you and the more that you inhabit some of the power. And the idea being that even Gollum knows that when the ring is destroyed, he's dead straight away because he's like he's 1,000 years old already. And the only thing that's sustaining him is that he once had the ring. So he's like tied into the ring.
Yeah.
It's the same with the ring wraiths as well. You know, they're actually at the same level in some ways that their power level is when they get killed, they can go back and get a new body.
Right. Okay.
You understand?
Yeah.
Like in the first movie, they get washed away by the river.
Yeah.
And their horses are all killed and they're like, ah, shit. And then they back in Barad-dûr, they kind of get new cloaks and they get like these winged serpents and they go out again. They're like, they're also immortal spirits that can like become re-embodied.
Yeah.
And they're flying around the Black Gates and Mordor. That's why the eagles can't just take the guys over and drop the rings into the things, because air control, it's air superiority. The Nazgul have air superiority there.
Yes.
What was I going to say?
Gollum.
Oh, yeah, the ring. So, I like in the book, it's a bit more explicit about, like, these rings are, like, can mess you up and give you power, but it's like, the temptation is there. And what the coming back to the power is that the reason why Gollum could last so long was because he was so non-powerful. Hobbits are almost the lowest level of sentient beings.
Yeah.
And so the ring gives you more power.
Yeah.
And the more power that you have, the more power the ring will give you. That's why when Gandalf says, no, I can't have this.
So no, the less power you have, the more it can give you.
No. The more powerful you are, the more powerful the ring is for you. Which means the hobbits are the perfect ring bearers because they can take the ring, put it on and take it off. But it has less power over them because they are less powerful.
Oh, okay. Right. So it's more like their cup is very empty and the ring can just fill it up.
Okay, here's the thing. Say the ring can put your power up an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
And if you're a hobbit and your power is like you like eating things and you have, you know, 15 meals a day and you like looking at fireworks and you just want to get home and marry Rosie and become the mayor of Hobbiton or whatever it is. Like, if that's your power that you have or that's your desires and that's your wants and that's what you want to control in life, like Sam is like the perfect ring bearer when he needs it because he's like, I'm a gardener, he says, and I'm going to take this ring and I'm going to make the world much nicer. There's going to be flowers here and trees there and the hedgerows are going to be really nice. And you're like, that's great. If your power in the world is that you're a gardener, that's a really great line in the movie where they say, are you his bodyguard? He's like, no, I'm his gardener. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, very good. So that's what I'm saying. Like, and that is your, if your power is just that.
Yeah.
And like, Smeagol's power before he became like Gollum and things. His power was that like he liked going fishing, but he was like a bit sneaky. Mm. Like even at the time he was called sneaky. It's made very explicit that no hobbit has ever murdered another hobbit in the whole of the history of the Shire.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever murdered anything. And their life is about giving gifts to each other and presents. Yeah. The whole book one, the whole part of like The Ring Sets Out when they're talking about Hobbiton and notes on hobbits and stuff is to say like, look, if you've got like the most dangerous thing in the world, which is a connection to evil, which can 10x your power in your in and be make you 10 times more dangerous to everyone around you, how about giving to people who just like gardening, eating, and there's never been a hobbit murder in the history of the Shire?
Yeah.
Give them the ring. Perfect. And you're like, great.
Yes.
So even Smeagol, who was like the worst, sneakiest hobbit, who was already kind of had like a bad heart, was somebody who would cheat at golf. I don't know, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so Smeagol and Gollum are like, even if they've been holding on to the ring, the ring bearer for 1,000 years, they get the long life, they get the invisibility if they put the ring on.
Mm.
Although it's never really clear that if everybody gets the invisibility or if that's just what hobbits get, because they, you know, in the book, The Hobbit, they're like, hey, we've got these dwarves who we're going to do, but we need like a sneaky little person who can like help us, you know, be a burglar, be a robber. And they're like, Bilbo, come on along. And he's actually employed as like the thief, like sneaky character.
Yeah.
And in Lord of the Rings, that's why all of the halfling characters, they're all like thieves and pickpockets and things.
Yes.
That's what they are. That's the kind of level that they're on there. So maybe the invisibility just works on them. But in the whole of the Lord of the Rings, we never see anyone put on the ring except Frodo, Bilbo, and Gollum. Nobody else puts the ring on.
Right.
In any of the books.
Yes, true.
And so we never get to see what power the ring can give you. Of course, we see the ring wraiths, but they're different levels of power.
And we know that Gandalf shies away from it.
Gandalf already has a ring. He actually turns out he has one of the elf rings. He has the fire. There's three rings for the elves.
Yeah.
Galadriel has one. Elrond has one. And the other one was held by another elf and it was given to Gandalf to look after. So the entire time Gandalf has had this fire ring, and it's not mentioned until like the last paragraph of both the appendix and of the Silmarillion. It's like, oh, and the third ring. Did you know Gandalf had it the entire time? You're like, really?
Oh,
Gandalf?
Anyway.
So the point is that this ring gives more power and tempts people. And the more power that you have and the more powerful you want to be, the more the ring tempts you. So Gandalf already has a ring, is already really powerful, and for him it's a big test not to take the ring. Same with Galadriel. She's another one of the elf ring bearers. She's got another rings for the three rings from the elves. So they manage to withstand the power of the ring when it's offered to them. You take the ring, says Frodo. And Gandalf is like, no, don't offer me. No, that's too much for me. That would be too powerful. And Galadriel is like, yes, everyone will look at me and love me and despair. And you're like, oh, right, don't give it to Galadriel either, because if she gets Sauron's power, that would be a bit too much as well. So yeah, so I just really enjoyed this kind of thing about like who is tempted by the ring. Legolas, he's around the ring all the time. Gimli, no, doesn't really affect them. They've never touched the ring. They've never touched a ring.
Yeah.
They don't know what it's like and they haven't been tempted. Boromir though is like, he's tempted by the ring in a way because he knows the history of it, but only a little bit of the history of it, because it's made clear later on that Gandalf has been teaching these sons of the steward of Gondor. Faramir is like, you know, his star student down there as well. And you're just sort of like, did his father's got this Palantir, so did Boromir, and it's this weird thing, like this weird balance, like why are some people tempted by the ring when it's in front of them and some people aren't? And Sam is only tempted by the ring after he takes the ring for the first time.
Yeah.
For him, it's not a big thing until he thinks Frodo is dead and takes the ring and uses it. And then when he gives it back to Frodo, he's like, I can carry the ring. Let me take the ring. I can help you with the ring. And Frodo's like, no, it's my precious. And you're like, oh, shit. Oh, right. Okay. So, yeah, it's just, I just really like in the book that it's never explicit who is really tempted by the ring.
Yeah.
Who can be addicted to the ring in the same way that Gollum is. Yeah.
I think what it could tell us here is that no matter what your initial condition like inside how you are.
Yeah.
No matter that, depending on your experiences in life, what you get to see here, yeah, or whatever, that outside whatever can come in to you and you experience,
yeah,
can have an effect on how your original condition was,
yeah,
towards the ring. Like, yeah, if, for example, I would say with the Boromir and Faramir and what you just yeah, told me about, the one being more of the, like, the you know,
the student of Gandalf.
This kind of stuff can lead to jealousy and thinking like, oh, why, yeah, is that person treated better than me? What's like, and this kind of thinking and experience, yeah, can then have an impact on how your original condition, even if you were like a really happy, like gardener type Sam, yeah, person, depending on the circumstances you are in, that the things that you experience,
yeah,
that can have an impact on that as well.
Yeah.
And that is what the ring then...
Yeah. And also, it's like I was talking about before as well, that, like, who has the elf light in them? Aragorn is, you know, yeah, is one of these lines of the Numenorean kings or whatever. And he has... Yeah, he's... And Legolas is an elf, so maybe he's not tempted as,
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
But, again, the elves who are tempted by the ring, like... What's his name? Glormingle or whatever, the elf name, which Glorfindel, the one who turns up and helps them in the first book, you know, takes them across the river and things. And yeah, he's not tempted by the ring, and yeah, other people aren't tempted by the ring. So
well,
I think,
well, maybe if you have enough powers that you don't need the, yeah, ring, so just can't give you
and
anything.
So I think that the people who are tempted by the ring and then turn it down is Gandalf, who is a ring bearer,
mm,
Galadriel, who is a ring bearer, and then men who have no elf in them,
mm-hmm,
and then Gimli is a dwarf and he's not tempted by that ring,
yeah,
or whatever it is, if you know what I mean. Dwarves have got their own set of rings that they've been tempted by.
Yeah.
So again, who knows? But I like thinking about this kind of stuff, and that not all of this stuff is explicit. Now, if this was Brandon Sanderson, he'd already have like four different schematics of like how everything technically works.
Yeah.
And also the characters in the book, one of the main things that they would be interested in is how does this all work, and mm, how can I get more powerful if I work, mm-hmm, out the right blueprint
how
for this
spell? How can we hack it?
Yeah, how can we hack it?
Yeah.
And in Lord of the Rings, there is no hacking the magic system.
No.
The magic system is like, there isn't a magic system. It's more cosmology and theology,
mm,
and God works in mysterious ways and the world works in mysterious ways, and it's told from the point of view of hobbits who don't always understand what's going on,
yeah,
around them.
Yes.
And they're like, wait, dwarves glow in the dark? No, not dwarves. Elves glow in the dark when I put the ring on? It's sort of like, oh yeah. Oh, that's why elves are so special, because they exist in the spiritual plane, yeah, and the mortal plane at the same time.
Yeah.
Or our plane, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So
having this story being told by the most innocent, yeah, unknowing people,
yeah,
is a really good it's a really good way of telling the story,
yeah,
because we also,
yeah, we're the outsider in the story. Yeah, and they're the outsider. They come out of the Shire and they're like, wait, the Shire is just like, you know Wiltshire or, you know, whatever it is, and and now if over here.
Yeah. Oh, the world is so much bigger.
It's so much bigger. So everything is new to them. They're like, I want to see an elephant. I'm sorry, an oliphant.
Yeah.
They tell the oliphant rhyme. It's like, big as a house. Looks like a snake in some ways. And sometimes looks
unless, like... Unless Andy Serkis sings it, you don't want to hear it.
Well, no, I'm not going to talk about Andy Serkis singing.
All right.
That was it. I've got to the end of my notes. My next note is Return of the King. And then I've got book 5, Men. And yes. So I want to talk about Men,
yes,
up next.
Sounds good.
But that'll be the next episode, because we've gone another hour and 23 minutes on this
one. I think it's a good package of podcast.
Yes.
All right.
Let's wrap it up there.
Yeah.
I always want to go across and see what my friends on Goodreads say about this.
Mm.
So this book is given a 4.5 rating, right, generally on Goodreads. And Goodreads used to tell you the average rating of your friends, but 251 of my friends and followers,
ooh,
or, you know, friends and people I'm following,
yeah,
have rated it or reviewed it. So yeah, lots of 5 stars there as well.
Yeah.
Paul, Diva, Diane, Buzz, Ryan, Julie, Marcus, Charlie, C, gives it 4 stars. Much more exciting and faster paced than Fellowship. Oh yeah, talking about the pacing, I wanted to actually wrap up like the overall book experience in the last one. That's what I'm going to end with tomorrow. So I'll talk about pacing of the entire thing.
Yeah.
in, I say tomorrow, whatever the next episode is.
Yeah.
We said we'd record this episode tomorrow and it's 2 days later. But yeah, lots of good things. Tolkien is still a master of language, says Ned. So yeah, lots of good reviews. I'll read through some more reviews once I press stop on the podcast here.
Sounds good.
In a minute. So what else are we reading? No, we'll do that tomorrow or in the next episode.
The next episode, and we'll reveal what we're reading at the moment.
And we'll reveal what the next episode, maybe another fantasy book that Juliana read, but we'll get to that in its own episode. Right, that's it. You can follow me on Mastodon and Blue Sky. Pretty much the same stuff is posted there. I just post announcements that the podcast is here. Then I read stuff there as well. So check it out. Yeah, and also email me, luke@juggler.net. Also, become my friend on Goodreads so I can see what you think of books that I have also read.
Yes.
And check out the community message board that we have on Goodreads. It's the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com. If you've got anything to say or anything that you want to share about Lord of the Rings, pop it there in the episode feedback thread on the Goodreads community. SFBRP. Was it? SFBRP listener group.
Yeah.
You can find it on Goodreads. We don't have a forum. We don't have a Discord.
Nope.
We don't have anything.
Nope.
We outsource our community discussion to Goodreads. So that's it from us. Thanks a lot for listening and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.